Because I want to live. Sorry to be so self-serving, but I've got a movie to make, I'm getting a new hybrid car, and I've just lost 50 pounds, and I sure as hell better live so I can lose the other 50. Bush's program of Homeland Security is providing us with no security at all. If you want real security, I suggest you consider my ideas that will definitely make America a safer country. 1. Catch Osama bin Laden. Whoa, there is an original idea. I guess someone forgot to do this. Didn't they tell us that Osama was the mastermind of 9/11? Wouldn't that make him a mass murderer? With all the capabilities we have, like being able to read a license plate number from a spy satellite in outer space, why hasn't this man been caught? Who's his travel agent? My theory, he's back home in Saudi Arabia being protected by those who have been funding him and getting the medical help that he needs for his failing kidneys. Or he's in Newark. Or he's right behind you, right now. Run away, run away. 2. When staging a coup and overthrowing the democratically elected leader of another country, do it right. Don't force the people of those countries to live under a U.S.-sponsored dictatorship as we did in Chile, Indonesia, and Guatemala. These regimes are set up primarily to allow U.S. corporations to run roughshod over their people. This type of behavior results in a certain unruly segment of the population just hating our guts. I know, what a bunch of crybabies. Still, we're the ones who often end up suffering. The best way to help spread democracy may be for us to not undo the democratic decisions people in other countries make. 3. Propping up existing dictators does not endear us to the people living under the rule of those dictators. Our history of siding with the wrong guy is extensive. We've picked more losers than a television executive. Saddam and the Saudi royals are only the start of a long list. Those living under the boot of these despots know that we're responsible for their suffering. 4. When attempting to prop up a Latin American dictator, try to do it without killing too many nuns or archbishops. It tends to give the natives, who are often very religious, a bad taste in their mouths, and some of them may get the weird desire to kill a few of us in return. 5. When attempting to assassinate the president of Cuba, make sure you get the right kind of exploding cigars. Failure to dispose of him properly, after we had just spent decades supporting his corrupt predecessors, gives the American position little credibility. 6. It might be good to find out why hundreds of millions of people on three continents, stretching from Morocco on the Atlantic to the Philippines in the Pacific, are so pissed off about Israel. Now, I'm not just talking about your everyday run-of-the-mill anti-Semites. You can find them on all seven continents, including Antarctica. No, I'm talking about a perceived notion that we Americans are supporting Israel in its oppression of the Palestinian people. Now, where did those Arabs come up with an idea like that? Maybe it was when that Palestinian child looked up in the air and saw an American Apache helicopter firing a missile into his baby sister's bedroom just before she was blown into 100 bits. Touchy, touchy. Some people get upset over the pickiest things. Is that any reason to dance in the streets when the World Trade Center falls to the ground? Of course, many Israeli children have died too, at the hands of the Palestinians. You would think that that would make every Israeli want to wipe out the Arab world. But the average Israeli does not have that response. Why? Because in their hearts, they know they are wrong. And they know they would be doing just what the Palestinians are doing if the sandal were on the other foot. Hey, here's a way to stop the suicide bombings. Give the Palestinians a bunch of missile-firing Apache helicopters and let them and the Israelis go at each other head-to-head. $4 billion a year to Israel, $4 billion a year to the Palestinians. They can just blow each other up and leave the rest of us the hell alone. 7. 5% of the world's population, that's us, use up 25% of the entire world's energy resources, and the well-off 16%, mostly the U.S., Europe, and Japan, use up 80% of the world's goods. To some, this seems to be a little greedy, and it's got to change. If there's not enough to go around because we're hogging everything, that will tend to get some people upset. They may say to themselves, how come we're living on a dollar a day and they aren't? It's not like we want them to live on a dollar a day, and if we could, we'd certainly give them another 50 cents a week, but God bless America, and we can't help that. 8. We need to offer the world a drink of water. Right now, 1.3 billion people can't have a glass of clean water. 1.3 billion? That's a lot of thirsty people. I say, give them a friggin' drink. If that's all it'll take to stop them from coming over here to kill me, it seems a small price to pay. There is no excuse, considering our wealth and technology, for not ensuring that everyone on this planet has safe, clean, and sanitary living conditions. What if we vowed to provide clean drinking water for everyone on Earth within the next 5 years, and then we did it? How would we be thought of then? Who would want to kill us? One cup of clean water, then maybe throw in some HBO and a Palm Pilot or two, and before you know it, they love us. They really love us. And no, we don't do this by letting Bechtel or Nestle go in, buy up water, and sell it back like they're already doing in many places. 9. People should be able to buy the products they are making. The way it is now, Manuel in Monterey, who just built your new Ford, will never be able to buy that Ford for himself. That might make Manuel a bit edgy toward us. Or how about that worker in El Salvador who makes 24 cents for each $140 NBA jersey she produces? Or the factory workers in China who earn 12 cents an hour making those cute toys for Disney? Or the workers making clothing for The Gap in Bangladesh, including pregnant women who are routinely beaten and slapped for production mistakes? America became well off when its workers were paid enough money to afford to buy the very houses and cars and stereos they built with their own hands. That made them happy, content, and not thinking thoughts of revolution or terrorism. The genius of Henry Ford was not only his invention of the assembly line, it was his idea that everyone should get $5 a day, a bonanza in those times. By keeping the price of the Ford low enough, all his workers would be able to buy one. Why have American corporations forgotten this lesson when they go abroad? It will be their doom. They say they are paying their overseas workers practically nothing so that the price of their products is kept low for American consumers. But the truth is they have moved these factories to foreign countries so they can pocket the profit. They made out handsomely when they produced things in the U.S. Henry Ford and his contemporaries were rich men. But the new rich are not content to settle for mere wealth. They have an insatiable desire to make as much as inhumanly possible. Enough is never enough for them. This gluttony will result in more of us losing our lives to angry terrorists from the third world. Let's make the fat cats share their wealth with those who make their products for them overseas. It's a good way to keep the rest of us safe. 10. No child must be a slave laborer. You know how parents are. They want their kids in schools, not sweatshops. While you are sending your child to school with a banana in his lunchbox, 10-year-olds in Ecuador are trotting off to work beside their parents at banana plantations where they earn nothing. If anyone complains, the company fires the kids and expects the parents to make up the extra workload. Who do you think pays for this when the child becomes an angry adult? 11. When we kill civilians, we shouldn't call it collateral damage. When they kill civilians, we call it terrorism. But we drop bombs on Iraq, and more than 6,000 Iraqi civilians are slaughtered. We then apologize for the spillover. Al-Qaeda bombs the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, 3,000 are slaughtered, and it's terrorism. But what right did we have to drop bombs on Iraq's civilian population? Were those civilians threatening any of our lives? I thought the only time you can take another's life is when they are about to take yours. Or did I miss something somewhere? Of course, it's hard to not kill civilians when even your smart bombs go dumb. In Iraq, about 1 in 10 went off course, blowing up homes, markets, and bakeries instead of missile defense systems. Hell, some of the smart missiles didn't even hit Iraq. They slammed into Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. Sorry about that. 12. When declaring your mission accomplished, make sure it really is. Otherwise, you might end up with a lot more dead soldiers. Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon all said at one time or another that the Vietnamese communists were on the run, defeated, or destroyed, and there was always a light at the end of the tunnel. Some 58,000 dead American kids later, not to mention 4 million Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Laotians, we finally figured out that the only way to accomplish the mission was to get the hell out of there. We've yet to apologize for our massacre. Something tells me that that mission has not been forgotten by the poor of the world. 13. One surefire way to make us really safe would be to destroy the weapons of mass destruction still in the hands of the nation that has killed more people with them than all other nuclear nations combined. Yes, let's destroy our weapons of mass destruction right here in the USA. Then let's call in Hans Blix to verify we did the job. Only after we smash every atom bomb into depleted uranium plowshares will we have the right to tell North Korea, India, Pakistan, Israel, and the rest that they don't need such weapons. Not only will we set a good example, but we'll save a lot of money, too. And we'll still have enough high-tech firepower to incinerate any people of our choosing or outgun any rogue nation. 14. We must immediately disavow Bush's preemptive war policy. We need to slam shut this insane Pandora's box Bush and Cheney have opened. The notion that it is ethical to kill people in case they want to attack us is not the way to relax the rest of the world when they see the stars and stripes. 15. Stop acting like a thief who says, "Stick 'em up, hand over your weapons, and, okay, now hand over your oil." Just go straight for the oil and cut out the bullshit about nation-building or democracy. Sure, it would be wrong, but it would be cheaper and more honest. And we wouldn't have to blow random civilians to smithereens. 16. Stop terrorizing our own citizens with the Patriot Act. And while you're at it, read 1984 by George Orwell, and stop naming things in ways that remind us of totalitarian dictators. If you don't have time to read it, then here are my favorite passages to post on your refrigerator. The two aims of the party are to conquer the whole surface of the earth and to extinguish once and for all the possibility of independent thought. All that was required of them was a primitive patriotism, which could be appealed to whenever it was necessary to make them accept longer working hours or shorter rations. They could be made to accept the most flagrant violations of reality, because they never fully grasped the enormity of what was demanded of them, and were not sufficiently interested in public events to notice what was happening. The capitalists owned everything in the world, and everyone else was their slave. They owned all the land, all the houses, all the factories, and all the money. If anyone disobeyed them, they could throw him into prison, or they could take his job away and starve him to death. When any ordinary person spoke to a capitalist, he had to cringe and bow to him, and take off his cap and address him as Sir. 17. Start bombing the hell out of people with white skin. I mean, right now it looks like we're prejudiced or something, only attacking nations with dark-skinned, non-Christian people. When France and Germany pissed us off, we should have bombed them. 18. And finally, let's set a good example. Remember that lesson about treating people the way you would like to be treated? It still works. When you treat people well, 99.9% of the time, they respond in kind. What if our entire foreign policy was based on that novel concept? What if we were known as the country that sought first to help people instead of seeking first to exploit them for their labor or their natural resources? What if we were known as the country that shared its incredible wealth, shared it even to the point where it might mean that we go without some of the luxuries we're accustomed to? How would the poor and desperate around the globe feel toward us then? Wouldn't this reduce our chances of being victims of terrorist attacks? Wouldn't it be a better world to live in all around? Isn't it the right thing to do? The fact is, the number of people willing to blow themselves up to kill you is infinitely small. Yes, anyone prepared to die for their cause may eventually pull it off, but those people exist everywhere, and they always have. The war on terror should not be a war on Afghanistan or Iraq or North Korea or Syria or Iran or whatever place we'll end up invading. It should be a war on our own dark impulses. We all need to take a deep breath and step back. What would it take for you to want to kill someone? What about 3,000 people? Or 4 million? That's right, it would take something awful that would have completely messed up your mind. Now, if you know what breeds a terrorist, and you see that you and I are the ones breeding them, doesn't it just make good common sense to stop doing that? I'm not saying that Osama or whoever else should just be free to go on his way. In fact, that was the first point. Catch that bastard. But what do you accomplish if you launch a war that scatters Al-Qaeda members around the globe? And what message are you sending to Muslim people who have lived under oppressive governments that you have, at one time or another, helped to keep in power? Yes, it's springtime in Terrorland, and we're germinating an entire region. Is this how to make the world safe? The only true security comes from ensuring that all people, here and around the globe, are able to meet their basic needs and dream of a better life. At the very least, we have to make damn sure we are not the ones robbing them of that dream. Chapter 6, Jesus W. Christ. Hi, God here. I hope you don't mind if I interrupt Mike's book with a few words from me, your almighty creator, but hey, I'm God. Who's going to stop me? You've probably heard my name bandied about quite a bit lately, and if there's one thing that really ticks me off, it's bandying. Another thing that really puts me in an ugly Old Testament mood is people taking my name in vain. And there is one individual who invokes me every chance he gets. He's passing himself off to you as my personal messenger. Remember, I see and hear everything, and here's some of what I've heard from this guy. I could not be governor if I did not believe in a divine plan that supersedes all human plans. I believe God wants me to be president. I feel the comfort and the power of knowing that literally millions of Americans I'm never going to meet say my name to the Almighty every day and ask Him to help me. My friend Jiang Zemin in China has about 1.5 billion folks, and I don't think he can say that. And my friend Vladimir Putin, I like him, but he can't say that. Can you believe this, nitwit? I actually like Putin and Jiang a lot. Do you think I keep making so many Chinese and Russians because I don't like them? I have a confession to make. Sometimes I screw up. Not all of my creations are perfect. And in the case of the human you know as George W. Bush, well, this is one that really got away from me. I'm not quite sure how it happened. I have a pretty strict inventory process, and it's rare that something I create turns out to be a clunker. But when I screw up big. Take Pompeii. I still don't know what the hell happened there. I was experimenting with a new mix of sulfur and dioxide and sugar-free cola, and before I knew it, boom! At least it's good for the tourism, unlike Atlantis, which was really embarrassing. Then there's Bangladesh. I was trying to get the land and the water levels just right, but I miscalculated and couldn't quite make it fit. You know how when you're making the bed and after you've pulled everything into place, and then there's always that one spot that just doesn't even itself out, so you kind of tuck it in under the mattress? That's Bangladesh. The whole damn thing is below sea level. All those floods were never meant to be a wrath of me thing. And yes, I do wish I had given you all eyes in the back of your heads. Bad design flaw. Also, you're right. There are not enough hours in the day. When I created the heavens and the earth, I should have rotated your axis a bit differently and given you at least an extra 5 hours of daylight to get all your errands done and get home in time to barbecue. Plus, who couldn't use 2 more hours of sleep each night? There are a few other things I'd also do differently. I'd never give any of you the brains to invent AstroTurf. I would strike down Clear Channel with one awesome lightning bolt. I would knock some sense into Tony Blair's head, and I would smite the entire Arena Football League. Believe me, when I get to do it over again, after you all have blown up the world, I'll get it right. But for now, what do I do about this Bush fellow? I keep hearing him say that he is acting on my behalf. Let's get one thing straight. This guy does not speak for me or anyone else up here. I do my own talking, or when I'm tired, I send down a prophet or two to do the yammering for me. Once I sent my son, but that just stirred up a shitstorm which still hasn't died down. Things didn't go too well for him, and frankly, our relationship is still a little strained over it. He's told me in no uncertain terms that he is never going back to Earth, second coming or no second coming. Send Gabriel is all he ever says to me when I broach the subject. I'd hate to have to come down there myself to straighten things out, because when I show up, it ain't a pretty sight. George W. Bush was not sent by me on any kind of mission whatsoever. He was not sent to remove Saddam, he was not sent to fight some axis of evil, and he was not supposed to be president. I have no clue how that one even happened. First, I answered all your prayers and removed his father from the presidency. Then, when his son showed up 8 years later, I again answered all your prayers, and that guy Gore got the most votes. Like you, I did not count on the interference of any other supreme beings or supreme courts. There was also the little problem of Lucifer rearing his ugly head in the form of someone who called herself Catherine Harris. How many times have I told you that Beelzebub has many disguises, Jim Baker, Antonin Scalia, and works in tricky, deceitful ways? In the beginning, I never really worried about this young Bush fellow because, in my divine plan, I created him to be one of your rich kid party boys. In the great mix of the universe, I allow for all kinds of people, and I create between 200 and 300 party boys a day, even more during spring break. You need them as much as you need the rocket scientists and cellists I send you. These boys are crucial to keeping the party going. They get people laughing, they line up the bands, they buy the drinks for the underaged. Then, after the party, they occasionally have to kill someone on the road because I need souls here on a steady, rotating basis. That's the way it works, and little Georgie was doing just fine until that 12-step program had to go and mess him up. Man, I hate those anonymous groups. AA, NA, OA, GA, all of them invoking my name to sober up, stop eating, and quit gambling. All of a sudden, no more sinners. That's not the way it works. I need sinners sinning and then repenting and then sinning again and always in my clutches so I can get some penance and good works out of them. When they stop sinning and start surrendering themselves to a higher power, then the whole threat of hellfire and damnation that keeps them doing my will goes out the window. Well, that's what happened to this particular party boy. Before I could whip up a plague of locusts, W was off the divine plan. I tried my best to make his life as miserable as possible. I saw to it that every one of his business ventures failed. I made sure that his baseball team sucked beyond belief. I even appeared to him in a dream one night and convinced him to trade away Sammy Sosa. And then, just to rub it in, I made Sosa a home run king when he went to his new team. But nothing would defeat George W. So I put his father in the White House, thinking, how could little Georgie survive this? It drove Brother Neil into the SNL scandal, and it forced Brother Marvin into hiding. But it didn't faze George at all, and he found ways to use it for his benefit. Before I knew it, he was governor of Texas and was deciding when people would die. That's my job. I don't know, maybe I'm getting old, maybe I'm slowing down, but nothing I tried, not even making sure he lost the election, did the trick. Soon, he was all-powerful and ruling the world. Many of you gave up on me. The praying stopped, and cursing began. Oh, yes, I have feelings, too. And it hurts. It really does. Who do I have to turn to in my time of need? The Holy Ghost? That guy is useless. Never around. Never leaves a forwarding address. So, for the few of you who still hold some faith in me, let me assure you of the following. 1. I am the Lord thy God, and he is the son of George, not the son of God. I will have him spending eternity parking cars in hell's VIP lot as soon as I get my hands on him. 2. I did not order Bush to invade any countries. It is still wrong to kill other human beings unless they have a really big knife at your throat and all pleas for mercy and a warning shot have gone unheeded. Killing humans is my job, and boy, do I love it. You've all gotten me so pissed off, I may just axe another 10,000 of you tonight. 3. I do not want school kids praying to me in a classroom. Save it for the church and before bedtime. That's enough for the little tykes. You keep forcing them to pray to me, they're going to hate my ass. Stop it. 4. An embryo is an embryo. A fetus is a fetus. And a baby is a baby. That's the way I set it up. When it is a baby, then it becomes a human being. You humans are difficult enough. I don't need more of you around any sooner than necessary. And while we're on the subject, I really don't care about your sex lives, as long as they're consenting and adult. Just keep it to yourselves, okay? 5. One more thing on the subject of creation. Let me state once and for all that I did not invent and do not endorse creationism. It's a completely bogus concept, right up there with the New Hampshire primary and non-alcoholic beer. I'm an evolution guy, despite what the Neanderthals claim in my name. Who do you think created science? Only a higher power could come up with something so complex and miraculous. 6. I do not approve of plaques and monuments with the Ten Commandments and other religious material being displayed in public buildings. My little-known 11th commandment? Keep your religious convictions to your own damn selves. 7. As far as those other religions go, 2 points of clarification. 1. There are never going to be 72 virgins waiting for you up here. We haven't had a virgin up here since Jesus' mother, and you're not getting anywhere near her. So save yourself the dynamite and blown-to-bits body parts because you aren't ever getting a room in my joint. And 2, there is no promised land. That big truckload of sand I dumped in that horrid little strip between the Mediterranean and the River Jordan, nobody was supposed to live on it, let alone fight over it to the point where it may result in the end of the world. I did not give that land to the Israelites. I did not give that land to Muhammad. And if everyone keeps using me as the landlord, I'm going to settle the dispute once and for all. So knock it off. 8. And finally, no more of this God bless America crap. What makes you think you get to be blessed and no one else does? I don't play favorites. You don't hear anyone in Djibouti saying, God bless Djibouti. I have never heard anyone utter the words, God bless Botswana. They know better. Let's get this straight. God don't bless America. God don't bless anyone. God has got a tea time on the back nine, and he doesn't have time to be interrupted with this patriotic mumbo-jumbo. Go bless yourselves, and quit using my name as a justification for feeling superior to everyone else. You aren't. You are actually among the dumbest people on the planet. Don't think so? Name the president of Mexico. See? Ask anyone else in the world the name of the leader of the country next to theirs, and they can tell you who it is. God bless America? More like God bleeps America. Look, I'm asking for a little help here. I realize I should have put an end to this madness a few days after 9/11, when George W. said, on the altar of the National Cathedral, that it was his mission now to rid the world of evil. People started to believe that he was going to do it. Well, you can't rid the world of evil, because evil is necessary to define what is good. If there were no evil, there would be no me. Evil is a necessary element for you humans, a way for me to test you, challenge you, to give you the chance to decide with your free will whether you will choose evil or good. You want to get rid of some evil? Why not start with eliminating a bit of the evil you've created? Letting people live on the street without a home is evil. Allowing millions of your children to go hungry, that is evil. Watching endless hours of reality television when you could be having really raunchy sex with someone you love, that is evil. You want to fight an evildoer? Go smack yourself around the room for an hour. Then go out and defeat the devil in the big White House. That is your mission. Fail me, and you'll be toast. That is all. God has spoken. Now, back to the rest of this audiobook. Chapter 7. Horatio Alger Must Die. Perhaps the biggest success in the War on Terror has been its ability to distract the nation from the corporate war on us. In the 2 years since the attacks of 9/11, American businesses have been on a punch-drunk rampage that has left millions of average Americans with their savings gone, their pensions looted, their hopes for a comfortable future for their families diminished or extinguished. The business bandits and their government accomplices who have wrecked our economy have tried to blame it on the terrorists. They have tried to blame it on Clinton, and they have tried to blame it on us. But in fact, the wholesale destruction of our economic future is based solely on the greed of the corporate mujahideen. There is a master plan, my friends. Each company has one. And the sooner you can get over not wanting to believe it, or worrying that to believe it puts you in the ranks of the nutters who thrive on conspiracy theories, then the sooner we have a chance of stopping them. Their singular goal is to take enough control over our lives so that, in the end, we'll be pledging allegiance not to a flag or some airy notions of freedom and democracy, but to the dictates of Citigroup, Exxon, Nike, GE, GM, P&G, and Philip Morris. It is their executives who now call the shots, and you can go vote and protest and cheat the IRS all you want to get back at them, but face it. You are no longer in charge. You know it and they know it, and all that remains is the day when it will be codified onto a piece of paper. The Declaration of the Corporate States of America. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women and their underage children are created equally to serve the corporation, to provide its labor without question, to accept whatever remuneration without complaint, and to consume its products without thought. In turn, the corporation will provide for the common good, secure the defense of the nation, and receive the bulk of the taxes taken from the people. It doesn't really sound that absurd anymore, does it? The takeover has happened right under our noses. We've been force-fed some mighty powerful drugs to keep us quiet, while we're being mugged by this lawless gang of CEOs. One of these drugs is called fear, and the other is called Horatio Alger. The fear drug works like this. You are repeatedly told that bad, scary people are going to kill you, so place all your trust in us, your corporate leaders, and we will protect you. But since we know what's best, don't question us if we want you to foot the bill for our tax cut, or if we decide to slash your health benefits or jack up the cost of buying a home. And if you don't shut up and toe the line and work your ass off, we will sack you. And then just try to find a new job in this economy, punk. That shit is so scary, of course we do what we are told. Mind our P's and Q's in our dreary cubicles. And fly our little American flags to show that, yes, boss, we believe in your war on terror. The other drug is nicer. It's first prescribed to us as children in the form of a fairy tale, but a fairy tale that can actually come true. It's the Horatio Alger myth. Alger was one of the most popular American writers of the late 1800s. One of his first books, for boys, was called Ragged Dick. Alger's stories featured characters from impoverished backgrounds who, through pluck and determination and hard work, were able to make huge successes of themselves in this land of boundless opportunity. The message was that anyone can make it in America, and make it big. We're addicted to this happy rags-to-riches myth in this country. People elsewhere in other industrialized democracies are content to make a good enough living to pay their bills and raise their families. Few have a cutthroat desire to strike it rich. If they have a job that lets them go home after 7 or 8 hours of work and then gives them the standard 4 to 8 weeks of paid vacation every year, they're relatively happy. And with their governments providing health care, good free schools, and a guaranteed pension to live well in old age, they're even happier. Sure, some of them may fantasize about making a ton more money, but most people outside the U.S. don't live their lives based on fairy tales. They live in reality, where there are only going to be a few rich people, and you are not going to be one of them. So get used to it. Of course, rich people in those countries are very careful not to upset the balance. Even though there are greedy bastards among them, they've got some limits placed on them. In the manufacturing sector, for example, British CEOs make 24 times as much as their average workers, the widest gap in Europe. German CEOs make only 15 times more than their employees, while Swedish CEOs get 13 times as much. But here in the U.S., the average CEO makes 411 times the salaries of their blue-collar workers. Wealthy Europeans pay up to 65% in taxes, and they know better than to bitch too loud about it, or the people will make them fork over even more. In the United States, we are afraid to sock it to them. We hate to put our CEOs in prison when they break the law. We are more than happy to cut their taxes even as ours go up. Why is this? Because we drank the Kool-Aid. We bought into the drug. The lie that we too could someday be rich. So we don't want to do anything that could harm us on that day we end up millionaires. The American carrot is dangled in front of us all our lives, and we believe that we are almost within reach of making it. It's so believable because we have seen it come true. A person who comes from nothing goes on to strike it rich. There are more millionaires now than ever before. This increase in the number of millionaires has served a very useful function for the rich, because it means in every community there's at least one person prancing around as the rags-to-riches poster child, conveying the not-so-subtle message, "See, I made it! You can too!" It is this seductive myth that led so many millions of working people to become investors in the stock market in the 1990s. They saw how rich the rich got in the 1980s and thought, "Hey, this could happen to me." The wealthy did everything they could to encourage this attitude. Understand that in 1980, only 20% of Americans owned a share of stock. Wall Street was the rich man's game, and it was off limits to the average Joe and Jane. And for good reason. The average person saw it for what it was, a game of risk. And when you are trying to save every dollar so you can send the kids to college, games of chance are not where you place your hard-earned money. Near the end of the 80s, though, the rich were pretty much tapped out with their excess profits and could not figure out how to make the market keep growing. I don't know if it was the brainstorm of one genius at a brokerage firm or the smooth conspiracy of the well-heeled, but the game became, hey, let's convince the middle class to give us their money and we can get even richer. Suddenly, it seemed like everyone I knew jumped on the stock market bandwagon, putting their money in mutual funds or opening up 401ks. They let their unions invest all their pension money in stocks. Story after story ran in the media about how everyday working people were going to be able to retire as near millionaires. It was like a fever that infected everyone. No one wanted to be left behind. Workers immediately cashed their paychecks and called their broker to buy more stocks. Their broker. Ooh, it felt so good. After working your ass off all week at some miserable, thankless job, you could still feel that you were a step ahead and a head above because you had your own personal broker, just like the rich man. Soon, you didn't even want to be paid in cash. Pay me in stock. Put it in my 401k. Call my broker. Then each night, you'd pore over the stock charts in the newspaper as one of the all-finance-news-all-the-time cable channels blared in the background. You bought computer programs to map out your strategy. There were ups and downs, but mostly ups, lots of ups. And you could hear yourself saying, "My stock's up 120%. My worth has tripled." You eased the pain of daily living, imagining the retirement villa you would buy someday, or the sports car you could buy tomorrow if you wanted to cash out now. No, don't cash out. It's only going to go higher. Stay in for the long haul. Easy Street, here I come. But it was a sham. It was all a ruse, concocted by the corporate powers that be, who never had any intention of letting you into their club. They just needed your money to take them to that next level, the one that insulates them from ever having to actually work for a living. They knew the big boom of the 1990s couldn't last, so they needed your money to artificially inflate the value of their companies, so their stocks would reach such a phantasmal price that, when it came time to cash out, they would be set for life, no matter how bad the economy got. And that's what happened. While the average sucker was listening to all the blowhards on CNBC tell him that he should buy even more stock, the ultra-rich were quietly getting out of the market, selling off the stocks of their own company first. At the same time, they were telling the public and their own loyal employees that they should invest even more in the company because forecasters were predicting even more growth, the executives were dumping their own stocks as fast as they could. In September 2002, Fortune magazine released a staggering list of these corporate crooks who made off like bandits while their company's stock prices had dropped 75% or more between 1999 and 2002. They knew the downturn was coming, so these executives secretly cashed in while their own employees and common shareholders either bought up more stock, "Look, honey, we can get GM now really cheap," or held on to their rapidly depleting worth in the hopes that it would bounce back. It has to. It always has before. They say you have to be in the market for the long haul. At the top of the list of these evildoers was Quest Communications. At its peak, Quest shares traded at nearly $40. 3 years later, the same shares were worth $1. Over that period, Quest director Phil Anschutz and its former CEO, Joe Nocio, and the other officers made off with $2.26 billion, simply by selling out before the price hit rock bottom. My corporate overlords here at AOL Time Warner stuffed their pockets with $1.79 billion. Bill Joy and Ed Zander and their friends at Sun Microsystems, $1.03 billion. Charles Schwab of, yes, Charles Schwab, took home just over $350 million all by himself. The list goes on and covers every sector of the economy. With their man Bush in the White House and the economy pushed about as far as it could go, the market took a wallop. It was at first massaged with that old chestnut that the market is cyclical. Don't take your money out, folks. It will come back up, just as it always does. And so the average investor stayed in, listening to all the rotten advice. And the market kept going down, down, down. So low it looked insane if you took your money out. It had to have bottomed out by now, so just hang tight. And then it just went down further, and before you knew it, your money was gone, gone, gone. Over $4 trillion was lost in the stock market. Another $1 trillion in pension funds and university endowments is now no longer there. But here's what's still here. Rich people. They are still with us, and they are doing better than ever. They laughed all the way to the Swiss bank over the scam of the millennium. They pulled it off, mostly legally, and if they bent the law here and there, no problem. There aren't more than a small handful of them behind bars as I write this. The rest, they're on the private beach with the well-groomed sand. So here's my question. After fleecing the American public and destroying the American dream for most working people, how is it that, instead of being drawn and quartered and hung at dawn at the city gates, the rich got a big wet kiss from Congress in the form of a record tax break, and no one says a word? How can that be? I think it's because we're still addicted to the Horatio Alger fantasy drug. Despite all the damage and all the evidence to the contrary, the average American still wants to hang on to this belief that maybe, just maybe, he or she, mostly he, just might make it big after all. So don't attack the rich man, because one day, that rich man may be me. Listen, friends, you have to face the truth. You are never going to be rich. the chance of that happening is about 1 in a million. Not only are you never going to be rich, but you're going to have to live the rest of your life busting your butt just to pay the cable bill and the music and art classes for your kid at the public school where they used to be free. And it's only going to get worse. Whatever benefits you may have now are going to get whittled down to nothing. Forget about a pension. Forget about Social Security. Forget about your kids taking care of you when you get old because they are barely going to have the money to take care of themselves. And don't even think about taking a vacation, because odds are your job won't be there when you get back. You are expendable. You have no rights. And, by the way, what's a union? I know, many of you don't think it's that bleak. Sure, times may be tough, but you think you'll survive. You'll be that one person who somehow escapes the madness. You are not going to give up the dream of someday having your slice of the pie. In fact, some of you believe the whole pie might someday be yours. I have some news for you. You're not even going to get to lick the plate. The system is rigged in favor of the few, and your name is not among them. Not now, and not ever. It's rigged so well that it dupes many otherwise decent, sensible, hard-working people into believing that it works for them, too. It holds the carrot so close to their faces that they can smell it. And by promising that one day they will be able to eat the carrot, the system drafts an army of consumers and taxpayers who gladly, passionately fight for the rights of the rich, whether it means giving them billions in tax breaks while they send their own children into dilapidated schools, or whether it means sending those children off to die in wars to protect the rich man's oil. Yes, that's right. The workers' consumers will even sacrifice the lives of their own flesh and blood if it means keeping the rich fat and happy because the rich have promised them that someday they can join them at the table. But that day never comes, and by the time the working stiff has figured this out, he's in an old age home spewing a lot of bitter mumbo-jumbo about authority and taking it out on the aide who was just trying to empty his sorry bedpan. There might have been a more humane way to spend his final days, but the money that would have financed that was spent by him on all that fantastic AOL Time Warner and WorldCom stock, and the rest was spent by the government on that outer space weapons system that never did quite seem to work. If you are still clinging to the belief that not all of corporate America is that bad, consider these three examples of what our good captains of industry have been up to of late. First, are you aware that your company may have taken a life insurance policy out on you? Oh, how nice of them, you say. Yeah, here's how nice it is. During the past 20 years, companies including Disney, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, Dow Chemical, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Walmart have been secretly taking out life insurance policies on their low and mid-level employees and then naming themselves, the corporation, as the beneficiary. That's right. When you die, the company, not your survivors, gets to cash in. If you die on the job, all the better, as most life insurance policies are geared to pay out more when someone dies young. And if you live to a ripe old age, even long after you've left the company still gets to collect on your death. The money does not go to help your grieving relatives through hard times or to pay for the funeral and burial. It goes to the corporate executives. And regardless of when you croak, the company is able to borrow against the policy and deduct the interest from its corporate taxes. Many of these companies have set up a system for the money to go to pay for executive bonuses, cars, homes, trips to the Caribbean. Your death goes to helping make your boss a very happy man sitting in his jacuzzi on St. Bart's. And what does corporate America privately call this special form of life insurance? Dead peasants insurance. That's right, dead peasants. Because that's what you are to them, peasants. And you are sometimes worth more to them dead than alive. It's also sometimes referred to as dead janitor's insurance. When I read about this in the Wall Street Journal last year, I thought I had mistakenly picked up one of those parody versions of that newspaper. But no, this was the real deal, and the writers, Ellen Schultz and Theo Francis, told some heartbreaking stories of employees who died and whose families could have used the money. They wrote of a man who died at 29 of complications of AIDS. who had no life insurance of his own. His family received no death benefits, but CM Holdings, the parent company of the music store where he worked, collected $339,302 at his death. Another CM Holdings policy was taken out on an administrative assistant who earned $21,000 a year, who died from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease. According to the Journal story, the company turned down a request from her grown children, who cared for her during her illness, to help buy a $5,000 wheelchair so they could take their mother to church. When the woman died in 1998, the company received a payout of $180,000. Some of the companies, Walmart among them, have stopped the practice. Some states have enacted laws banning dead peasants policies, and others are considering similar actions. And numerous lawsuits have been filed against companies by survivors of deceased employees seeking to be named the beneficiaries of the policies. But for now, the policies continue at many companies. Is yours one of them? You might want to find out. It's good to know that after you die, your corpse could in fact mean a new Porsche for the chairman. Still not convinced that the rich could care less about you? Here's another example of just how little you mean to your corporate masters once they've got your vote and your obedience. Congress is considering a bill that will let companies put less money into your pension funds if you work in a blue-collar job, because they say, as a result of the filthy, unsafe working conditions they've created for you, you aren't going to live that long anyway. So companies don't need to really be planning to give you all your retirement money because, heck, you ain't going to be around to use it. You'll be dead because they didn't install enough ventilation, or they made you work so hard you'll be lucky if you're not coughing up blood by the time you're 58. So why make them set aside all this pension money for you? What's even more disgusting about this legislation is that it is backed by unions, such as the UAW, who wants to see the pension money used now in the form of higher wages for their workers. But the numbers don't add up. Blue-collar workers who are union members actually live longer than non-union industrial workers because they are paid better and have good health benefits. People with more money who have access to health care tend to stick around longer in this life and thus need more, not less, money put into pensions to support them during their lengthy retirements. The third example of how expendable you are comes from our good friends in the Bush administration's Environmental Protection Agency. They have a plan called the Senior Death Discount. Corporate polluters have complained for a long time about how the government figures the actual cost in human lives of their poisoning of the air and water. The EPA develops its regulations and establishes fines, in part by calculating how many people will die as a result of the pollution. So, they came up with a number for the actual worth of a human life, $3.7 million. See, you are worth millions after all. But the business community complained. They said, no way are all these schmucks worth nearly $4 million. So the Bush EPA came up with a neat little math trick. They said, okay, in order to reduce your costs and your efforts to clean up your pollution, we'll now say that anyone over 70 is only worth $2.3 million. After all, they're almost finished anyway, and they aren't producing anything for you anymore, so their lives just aren't worth as much. That's when critics coined the policy, the Senior Death Discount. The elderly protested, and EPA Director Christy Whitman claimed the agency would stop using the calculation, and then she resigned. So you slaved your life away, you worked long hours, you gave everything you had to help your company earn record profits. When you went into the voting booth, you voted for their Republican and Democratic candidates just like they asked you to. And after you retired, this is the thanks you got. A senior discount. Not just at the movies or at McDonald's, but on your very life. Look, I don't know how to put it any gentler than to say that these bastards who run our country are a bunch of conniving, thieving, smug pricks who need to be brought down and removed and replaced with a whole new system that we control. That is what democracy is supposed to be about. We, the people, in fucking charge. What happened to us? Perhaps we never were really in charge, and those words just sounded good at Independence Hall on that sweltering day in 1776. Maybe if the Founding Fathers had air conditioning and a corporate jet, they never would have written such a foolish thing. But they did, and that's what we're left to work with. So how did we let the bad people win out? The ones who would have been blowing George III back then if they had half a chance. When are we going to get this country and its economy in our hands, electing representatives who will split the pie fairly and see that no one gets more than their fair share? Instead, what we have are sad realities like this one. The two bosom buddies, George W. Bush, CEO of America, and Kenneth Lay, chairman of Enron, the seventh largest company in the U.S. Before its collapse, Houston-based Enron was raking in a monstrous $100 billion a year, mostly by trading contracts for commodities, including oil, gas, and electricity around the world. The increasingly deregulated energy market was a goldmine for the company, which was known for aggressive deal-making. Lay, affectionately nicknamed Kenny Boy by Bush, was never shy about public displays of friendship. Enron donated $736,800 to Bush from 1993 on. Between 1999 and 2001, CEO Lay raised $100,000 for his pal and personally contributed $283,000 to the Republican National Committee. Lay also graciously gave candidate Bush use of the Enron corporate jet during the presidential campaign, so he could fly his family around the country and talk about his plan to restore dignity to the White House. This friendship was truly a two-way street. Bush interrupted an important campaign trip in April 2000 to fly back to Houston to watch Lay throw out the first pitch at the Astros' opening day game at the new Enron Field. Who said men aren't sentimental? After Bush became president, he invited Lay to come to Washington to personally conduct the interviews of people who would serve in the Bush administration, primarily for high-level positions in the Energy Department, the very regulatory agency overseeing Enron. Harvey Pitt, the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission at the time, was a former lawyer for Enron's accountant, Arthur Anderson. Lay and the Anderson team also worked to make sure that accounting firms would be exempt from numerous regulations and would not be held liable for any funny bookkeeping, arrangements that would come in handy later. The rest of Lay's time in Washington was spent next door with his old buddy, Vice President Dick Cheney. The two formed an energy task force responsible for drafting the country's new energy policy, a policy that could affect virtually all of Enron's business dealings. Cheney and/or his aides met with Enron executives at least six times during this period, but no one knows the full extent of the meetings because Cheney has refused to make public the records of those meetings. Meanwhile, Enron's Wheeler dealers were cooking up schemes to manipulate an energy crisis in California that would end up adding millions to their own pockets. Does any of this ring a bell? You may have forgotten, with all the military distractions that have taken the focus off of Enron, that this was one of the greatest corporate scandals in the history of the United States, and it was committed by one of the president's closest friends. I'm sure Bush thanks God every night for the War on Terror, 9/11, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Axis of Evil, all but assured that Enron would disappear from the news and from the minds of the voting public. This scandal should have resulted in Bush's early impeachment and removal from our White House, but fate often has a way of working in Bush's favor and letting him escape the consequences of his actions. As I've pointed out before, when you've had three run-ins with the law, as he has, and never spent a single night in jail, you have the lucky touch, and for people like him, it rarely goes away. But I, for one, will not forget Enron, and neither should you. It's an event that goes beyond corporate malfeasance to a concerted plan to wreck our economy and elect political hacks who would protect them in their scheme to attack America from within. when things were good at Enron, they were very, very good. Lay and other high-ranking honchos took home huge paychecks and enjoyed generous expense accounts and lavish perks. The sweet life at Enron helped them afford to make significant donations to politicians in both major parties, politicians who were able to ensure that the regulatory climate stayed very, very sympathetic to Enron's interests. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, Enron gave nearly $6 million to the Republican and Democratic parties since 1989, with 74% going to the Republicans. This meant that when Congress began investigating Enron at the beginning of 2002, 212 of the 248 members of the House and Senate on the investigating committees had taken campaign contributions from Enron or its crooked accountant, Arthur Anderson. Even lower-level Enron employees thought they had a good deal going. They sat back and watched their retirement plans, heavily invested in Enron stock, grow and grow. But the company's phenomenal success was fleeting and fraudulent. Much of Enron's profitability